And welcome back, Earth Explorers, to X-Squared Radio. We're so glad that you're here with us today. We're coming to you live from east of the Appalachians. This month, from the 13th to the 17th, is the Questers Conference up in Calgary, Canada. If you're in the area, why don't you stop by and see us? I'll be speaking up there. And then in July is the ESETI Conference. Don't forget that one. It's coming up. Also, Remembering the Future is out in ebook right now. We're trying to make sure we get it in your hands as quickly as possible while we're waiting for the print version to come out. It's about 58 days until we see the book come out in print. But you can get your hands on it now, read it, and in buying the ebook, you get 25% off the printed version. So you could have the autographed version on your bookshelf and the knowledge in your head. Go to rememberingthefuturebook.com, rememberingthefuturebook.com, and don't forget to catch us on Web Talk Radio. We're making a run for syndication out there. We're still a proud member of the BBS Radio Network, have been now for 5 years, and in the top 1% on that network, and we're proud to be there. My guest tonight is Dr. Amit Goswami. He is a theoretical physicist with a quantum activist mind. And we'll be back in 40 seconds with more. Don't go away. This is X Squared Radio. Better have your seatbelt on.
The spice extends life. The spice expands consciousness. The spice is vital to space travel.
It appears quantum physics is catching up with an ancient idea of dependent co-arising, says Dr. Goswami. We're going to discuss the spiritual aspects of that, where science and spirituality get wrapped up in the same fabric. Here we go. Dr. Goswami, welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be back.
Question, is the human race evolving?
Yes. Human race is very much evolving. It has passed through, mind has four evolutionary stages. Mind, property of mind is to give meaning to the world. The consciousness that is the ground of being has four different worlds of possibility. It's really, we don't really live in a universe. We live in a multiverse. The multiverse consists of a world of matter, a world of vital energy, a world of mind, and a world of archetype, which Aurobindo, a sage in India in the last century, called supermind, supramental. So if you take that into account, then it follows that mind gives meaning to four different worlds. The material is only one of them. So that part of the mind is called the physical mind. We already have developed a pretty good physical mind. You know, scientists today, they are people who are dominated by the physical mind. Everything is physical according to them, many of them. Then there is the vital mind. Many people have that characteristic. Carl Jung actually, found this characteristic, four different traits of personality. People where the vital mind dominates, those are the feeling-dominated mind, according to Carl Jung. Many women especially have that characteristic, but men too. And those are the two phases of human evolution that we have already completed, anthropologically speaking. Not very well, because we still continue to do that, and the vital mind especially has not really been integrated very well. But the third stage of the mind that we are in right now is when mind gives meaning to mind itself. In other words, meaning of meaning. Rational thinking is part of it. So this is also called the age of the rational mind. This is what we are belonging right now. We are developing our rational mind more and more, or trying to anyway, because the negative emotions create problems. Part of the vital mind that is unresolved as of yet creates problems. But there is a next stage, which we have only begun in the sense that the greatest among us, those people whom we call spiritual, they have already started this intuitive mind, when mind gives meaning to the great archetypes, love, beauty, justice, truth, goodness. Ethics was discovered, 2,500 years ago, or maybe even longer. But really, we have not gone very far with ethics. Hardly anybody today, for example, thinks of ethics as something to pursue, something as compulsory. We know about ethics. We read about ethics as philosophy, but we don't really engage with ethical questions anymore, because the materialist science that we that our worldview is dominated by, in materialism, there is no scope for ethical thinking. So, but that is the future of the mind. This is what we are evolving towards. We are evolving towards an ethical mind. We are evolving towards an intuitive mind, where the supramental archetypes, they will dominate our thinking.
Well, I kind of think about ethics like I sort of compare this to manufacturing. In manufacturing, we used to have lines of inspectors that would go up and down the line to make sure products were being made correctly. And if they were made incorrectly, we threw them in a red bin and ground them up or threw them away or sold them as seconds. But now we approach manufacturing from a different point of view. Now we try to prevent errors instead of detecting errors. And I look at ethics a little bit that way as well. We're trying to write laws so that we can detect unethical behavior and try to make it economically unfeasible to conduct it. What we really should be doing is trying to prevent unethical behavior from the mind side by helping the human being evolve.
That begins with a worldview which has ethics as part of it. Previously, even 100 years ago, we did not have the materialist worldview so acute. We had what is called modernism. We had the validity of both mind and matter, although in a dualistic sense, so eventually that had to go because dualism has its own paradox. But now the point is that we have lost the veracity of mind because of the two equations, mind and matter. We have only accepted the matter as valid. Mind has no validity. Mind is an epiphenomenon of matter. And therefore, whatever mind thinks of, like ethical concepts, that's a mental construct, according to this view. And that is not important because it's only epiphenomenon of matter itself. This view has affected us mostly indirectly and much more negatively in an indirect fashion than in a direct fashion. Because in a direct fashion, even the staunchest materialist scientists will not directly attack ethics. Because, of course, without ethics, our social systems fall apart. Now, nobody will be that stupid. But the point is that indirectly, by demanding that matter is everything, they're already undermining ethics. And this surreptitious attack on ethics is catching up because in our schools, we no longer can emphasize ethics very much. Ethics has become only part of the religious teaching. But who takes religious teaching seriously anymore? I mean, Sunday schools still exist, I suppose, in the Christian part of the world. In the non-Christian part of the world, in some of the traditions, religions are very strong, like in the Islamic tradition. But that has its own disadvantage, So it is a peculiar place. Earth has become a very peculiar place to live today because of this complete confusion about the role of ethics in our life.
Well, I can see that because of these four things, matter, vital energies, mind, and supermental or supermind, if some of the pieces are missing, then they're not evolving. They're stuck as a Cro-Magnon with a suit on.
Very good. Yes, we sometimes when people get mad at each other, especially teenagers, they call the other as Neanderthal. I sometimes think of, shouting, oh, why are we moving backwards and becoming Neanderthal all of a sudden? Let's be sensitive towards ethics. Let's be sensitive towards the archetypes. Let's just realize that we are cutting ourselves short when we believe that we are matter only. Build up matter, made for matter, made with matter. it just does not make sense, but because matter cannot even give us simple experience, a subject-object split with which we experience reality. So if matter cannot even explain such an elementary thing, then how can we take the material worldview so seriously?
Yeah, exactly. Now, that's not to say that we're not going to pay any attention to matter. I mean, the factories need to run so that people have jobs, but let's not run factories making buggy whips. Let's run factories making things that are useful to people. I mean, for crying out loud, will we stop making cars that run on gasoline and start making cars that run on electricity? That makes a lot of sense. But
Absolutely. It makes a lot of sense, but, you know, until we wake up to the fact that we have to do it. We have to do it in order to save the environment, and we have to do it because the environment is not separate from us. Then only we can do it.
Yes.
Because then saving the environment becomes urgent and important because it's part of us that we are destroying. But unless that concept arises, we'll always, even in the disaster that is happening right now near Louisiana, you know, even then we are so callous. We are not even thinking that, we need energy to be sure, but we have alternatives. It's not true that we have to dig deep and win our environment in these coastal areas in order to get energy. It's just not true that we have to remain so dependent on foreign energy, and therefore the only way we can become energy sufficient is digging these holes in the ocean floor and putting our environment in disaster. This is just not true. We can live within sustainable energies. Only thing is that we have to cut down our material consumption and replace that by more of the consumption in subtle energies, in the affairs of the mind, in mental meaning, and eventually even the archetype. In other words, we invest in spiritual dimension rather than the material dimension.
Very good. You know, in your papers, you assert that matter in this reality is merely the possibility of quantum states. Does this mean that there is an average reality, like a Fourier transform of reality, is like the peak of population of realities because it has been observed into being?
Well, the only thing that possibility gives rise to probability. That is true. You are absolutely right. And there is an average that we can talk about. Many scientists get lost about this average that we can talk about. We can talk about because we can compare the average when we compare experimental data for a very large number of things and large number of events, which is what we do in physics and chemistry. We are always talking about very large number of objects. Even a thimbleful of matter will contain something like 10 to the power 23 molecules of matter, and you can see how large a number that is, you know, in terms of it's like a huge number, you know, a billion, quadrillion objects. So when we talk about such huge numbers, then of course we can get by with just the concept of average. But when we talk about human beings, the average just doesn't make any sense because, you know, does it make sense to say that I had 1.2 human beings or 1.5 or wives or, you know, the average.
No, but there's an average reality that we all kind of jointly experience, plus or minus our own individual interpretation of it.
No, we can talk about it, but it does not make any real impact on our day-to-day life because there, you know, we have to deal with single events, and what matters most is the single event happening to a single object, namely me, right?
Right.
We would not be satisfied by knowing that the average is fine. But what is happening to numero uno, what is happening to me in this particular moment, in this particular experience, if that is not happy, then I have to be concerned. I'm not happy with the fact that average is okay, right?
Yeah. Well, what converts the possibility into actuality, though?
Yeah, this is the crucial point. In the last hour, we went into that a little bit. So we have to conceive that it is the observer. But how can the observer do it? Observer can do it only if consciousness is the ground of being and material objects are possibilities of consciousness. So consciousness chooses out of these many faceted possibilities the one facet that he wants to experience. And that's the one that becomes manifest reality for him or her. So in this way, you see, consciousness is introduced in our world in such a way that there is no paradox. There is no paradox of thinking. The paradoxes arise from two kinds of thinking. One thinking is that everything is matter. Then you have a paradox of everything is possibility, what is making possibility into actuality, the question that you ask. All paradoxes arise if we think that we are separate from the universe. Then the paradox arises because how do we interact with the universe? What is the connecting principle? If it's a signal, it has to carry energy. But energy of the material world alone is always constant. So this is a paradox. How can we communicate then with the world? If we have consciousness that is non-material, it has to somehow communicate in order to choose. So in both ways, you get paradoxes. If you think that consciousness is the ground of being, that is the basic stuff, and then matter is possibility within consciousness, not separate from it, then you say that consciousness is choosing from its own multifaceted material object. And therefore, it can do it without exchanging any signal.
Yeah,
and this kind of communication has now been observed. There, this is called non-local communication. Non-local communication is the biggest big news in science. You know, really, it's not the big accelerator that is getting a lot of publicity. It's really this quantum non-locality, which is the greatest news in science ever since 1982. When it was first observed.
Well, you know, let's try to bring this paradox down to what the average person would see. For instance, a chair created by a craftsman or a machine from wood, and let's say it's put in a box, it's shipped to a store where it's bought, and then it grows old and it's thrown away, and perhaps salvaged by a secondhand store, and then bought again by a person who is innocently sitting on it playing cards. There is no thought about accepting the possibility it is a chair. It is actually a chair that materialized because of the consciousness of another being in a previous year. So can we claim that the consciousness of the craftsman survived in actuality as the chair for the card player?
Yeah, now you are asking very, very subtle questions. Consciousness manifest experience. So the experience of the chair was manifested by the builder. Builder built the chair, of course. And was builder's consciousness got into the chair? Yes, builder's consciousness got into the chair. We can even say that the builder's vital energies, another dimension of the builder. Builder is not just the material body. Builder also has vital energies that the builder feels. Those vital energies of the builder got correlated with the chair. So when I buy the chair and manifest the chair from possibility into actuality within my experience, like I'm sitting on the chair, I'm feeling the chair, with sensing the chair, and I'm looking at the chair, I'm receiving those optical signals also. And I'm experiencing at the same time the vital energy of this fellow who created the chair a year ago. If I'm very sensitive, I would notice subtle change in the feelings that I had before I sat on the chair. If you are very subtle, you can actually feel the energies of chairs and tables by going to a friend's house and see that indeed your energies change in very subtle ways. I don't know if you have ever noticed it. Sometimes it becomes very noticeable. Like if you go to a church where there have been many spiritual people who have meditated, who have prayed, and you sit down in such a church on a bench, and all of a sudden you are engulfed into total peace.
Yeah.
I don't know if it has ever happened to you, but it happens to me many times. This is why people go to temples, people go to churches, people go to mosques and pray. Because other people have prayed there. And so when you do that, you feel the energy of these people, all very loving energy, all very accepting energy, all very unity energy. And because you feel those energies, your own mind also quiet down.
Yeah, I've often found places, even though there weren't other people there at the time, that I've walked into and really felt maybe all the emotion or all of the pleading before God or angels or principalities or whatever that's gone on in that place. And it infuses, yeah, it infuses the mass, the molecules of that place, and becomes part of its energy.
Yes, and this energy is not the physical energy we're talking about. It's the vital energy. It's
right.
The energy connected to the life of these people that inhabited those places and prayed and meditated. And that's the energy that we feel, and that energy gives us that feeling of happiness or calmness or equanimity, whatever you may call it.
Well, we often talk about realities being possibilities and really the potential of all possibilities, but do the effects of our consciousness have perpetual actualities that actually reduce somewhat the possibilities of reality?
Well, possibilities of reality are never really reduced in the dimensions other than the material dimensions. In the material dimensions, indeed, there is the entropy law, which constantly is reducing some of the possibilities into unachievable. I mean, energy, for example, as we consume it, it becomes less and less available to do useful work.
Sure.
This is the reason that we need constantly new sources of energy. Without it, we cannot function, because we cannot, although energy can be converted from one form to another, but we cannot get the energy converted into available energy, converted into, for example, something useful like electricity. We cannot convert thermal energy into electricity very easily. Thermal energy of the environment, for example, we can never convert. So these are the difficulties in the physical dimension. But you're quite right. In the vital dimension, in the mental dimension, there is no such limitation. This is the beauty of them. How to shift from our overemphasis of the material dimension today to these subtle dimensions is the real question of our society and culture. If we could find ways, we have to. Otherwise, you know, we are really getting into limits of growth. You know, the Club of Rome report in 1970, you know, people, conservatives still poo-poo it, but it's really right. There is limits to growth in the material dimension. And we are now feeling some of the limits to growth. You know, global warming is constantly reminding us that we cannot go on polluting the environment in the search for material energy on and on and on. And we cannot base our economy always based on consumerism, which will always demand more energy. We got to find ways of living that involve more the subtle rather than the gross.
Well, civilizations have a way of reaching an asymptote where either the environment can't support any more human beings, there's not enough energy, not enough land, water, breathable air, and stuff like that. But there's also a technological asymptote where you have reached a point of progress where one of two things is going to happen. You either perish or you awaken.
Well put. And we are getting to that place where we are going to be in that crossroad. And I think we'll awake. I think we'll wake up pretty soon. We are moving in that direction. This paradigm shift that we are talking about tonight, is an example of that kind of movement. We are slowly, but surely, we are waking up. It has been a long slumber. You know, William Blake, a long time ago, called this Newton sleep. And Newton sleep did not go away with Newton. It continued on, this single vision, and it continues on and on and on in the 21st century, in the first decades. I think it's still dominating us. But I think starting about a few decades from now, we will change, and we will gradually wake up from that single vision and Newton sleep, using Blake's words.
Yeah, I see the change happening now, at least on small scales. And if those paradigms can get some access to capital, where they can actually spread their ability to produce and thus influence more lives, then maybe the change will happen more quickly. I'll tell you what I do see, and I'd like to ask you this question. Do you see the internet, the ability to communicate and move ideas instantaneously around the globe like we're doing right now, as part of that accelerated evolution? Not in the sense that we're all becoming a very wealthy society, but in the sense that we're maybe seeing that we don't need to be a wealthy society in order to evolve.
In fact, you know, I'll change your word just a little bit. Yes, first of all, the internet is going to be crucial in this change. Why? Because as we discussed earlier in the last hour, there is this quantum entanglement, this non-local communication between people without requiring any signal. But we are non-locally connected potentially with everyone. However, we don't feel it. We don't actually engage in a non-local communication with everyone. If we did, life would be impossible because we would be constantly communicating with people that we don't know with whom we are communicating. There is so much load, overload. It would be an informational overload. So to prevent that, there is an extra requirement for quantum non-locality. It's triggering. We have to locally, by interaction, trigger the non-local connection. So this triggering is always a problem. Only when I see you, then only we can communicate non-locally. Or we have some kind of a connection by prior arrangement. Then we also can non-locally connect with each other. Internet gives us the ability of this triggering to a large number of people at the same time without much effort. For example, the Twitter, Facebook, you know, these are communications between people who have become a community. If I write to my Facebook, I'm communicating with thousands of people all at once, which is then all non-locally, that non-local connection which was potential has now become actual. So in that moment of sending the email and they are receiving them, I am actually potentially capable of meditating together with them on the same kind of intention and bring it to fruition. I mean, yeah. Imagine the potential of that. So this is the kind of thing that internet has created.
Right, right. So we don't have to coordinate a meditative moment 2 weeks in advance by mail. We can do it,
right?
You know, exactly. 30 minutes in advance.
And, you know, and that has its own problems, too. Mail is undeniable. So, you know, and then here, of course, emails do get lost once in a while, but rarely. I think email is much more reliable.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. Hopefully the post office doesn't figure out a way to start charging for it. I'll go broke. You know, I sometimes refer to the mortal body as a biological transducer through which the universe can be sensed. It is limited in its levels of detection, however. Why, I mean, you mentioned earlier that we probably have lived multiple lives, and I too have the feeling that we've at least sat around a campfire or two drawing in the sand on these advanced ideas, and now we're talking again over the expanse of space via the non-local internet. Why do you think that the human body is so limited in its ability to directly sense the universe?
Well, probably it has a reason, because if it didn't, it as I said, there would be constant information overload. So to prevent that alone, we need to have, the brain has limited capacity to process. Many people ask, well, why does the brain have such limited capacity to process? It receives thousands upon thousands of bits of information, but it can process only a little bit of it. But imagine what would happen if it had bigger capacity. I think we'd be completely lost with information itself. We'd never be able to get into the meaning side of it. Information is not it. Information, of course, you know, computers can process a lot of information. But what does it give it? It gives it nothing. It does not have consciousness. It cannot process it. It does not know the meaning of any of the information that we can process with it, but we give the meaning. So if the world is completed in its fullness, appreciated in its fullness, where it's recognized that information is only part of the world, in fact, the secondary part of the world, and the bigger part of the world is how much meaning we can give to the information, then it becomes immediately clear that we better have information in small dosage, because our capacity for meaning is what matters the most. In fact, if you think about it, it's even beyond meaning. It's those supramental capacities. Ultimately, what we want is the capacity to be happy, capacity to love, capacity to be just to my neighbor, capacity to be good to my neighbor. These are the capacities I want to develop. And therefore, information overload is the least of things that I desire.
Well, yeah, that's true. It is the least of things. And some people get, they get trapped in the idea that seeing is believing, and if I can't see it, why, then, you know, then it's not real. If I can't wax it or put it in the bank, then I don't really need it. But when we realize that there's more than one way to observe the universe, not just our eyes and our ears and our nose and our fingers, but hands and senses, but there's a spiritual way to connect with the universe that is quite profound. And even from a scientific point of view, if we want to go and be purist about it, a direct observation is a fact, correct?
Yeah. Yes.
So if you make
observation without sickness is a fact. And this is what we have to constantly repeat and repeat and repeat whenever we have the opportunity to other people, our compatriots, so that this very fact that can, this is a paradigm shifting fact. That gets around, that everybody knows about, and then they won't think of themselves as being so limited. Because we think ourselves to be so limited, we become so worried about limited aspects, and we start fighting with each other for those limited aspects. If we knew that we have unlimited capacity in these dimensions that we ignore, then I don't think we would be so paranoid. We would not be so narrow in our in our behavior with other people.
Well, maybe we wouldn't be so fearful for sure, but it might be a little boring if we had all the answers and could observe everything all the time. There has to be a little bit of mystery. I want to make sure...
But it doesn't get boring. I mean, you know, this too is a concept that that has no place for it. Boring actually is a... arises from separateness, right?
Yes.
If I am whole with the one, then it is anything but boring.
Oh, yeah.
Boring is unsatisfactory because it is a separateness that we feel from the whole. We get bored. But suppose there is no separateness, that I cannot be bored, right? So this whole idea that somehow... somehow experiencing beauty or experiencing love all the time would be boring is a misconcept, totally.
I agree.
It comes from people who does not have the capacity, and therefore they cannot engage in beauty for a long period of time. And therefore, you know, we think that, well, it would be so boring if we could. But
right.
What has happened is that our capacity of looking at a sunset is limited to just that 1 second. And then that capacity is gone. It's an intuitive thing. And in this mind, which is so separate, we cannot intuit for very long. But suppose you could stay in that capacity. We could develop the capacity of staying in that supramental archetype for a long period. Then where is boredom? We would be completely full.
Right.
Is that my gist? You know, this happens to us in terms of one archetype only today. And that, even that is quite limited, which is the archetype of love. When we are in love, people have that capacity. People develop that capacity. And this is why love is so great, because it's our one entry point where we indeed have prolonged periods, you know, just not just a few seconds of enjoying beauty, but we have prolonged periods where we can love another person and be full. You know, those stories that are made for honeymoon couple, not even going out for dinner and lunch and breakfast and just having all their meals inside and piles of dishes piling up. You know, that's not, of course, it's It is partly mythological, but it's partly true also. I mean, we become so full, and we never feel separate. So those are very unique experiences of unity. And where is boredom in those states of consciousness? There is no boredom. When you are in love, do you feel bored with it?
No,
you don't, because you are whole. You are complete.
Right. I have been remiss this hour. I forgot to let you all know that the phone lines are now open. If you want to be part of the program, you can reach us from anywhere on planet or off planet at 415-762-1161. 415-762-1161 if you want to be part of the program. If you've been saving up your answer or your question, you can call in and give it to us now, or you can reach us by Skype. Some of you are already texting in by Skype, hence the brilliance of my questions already. You mentioned, Dr. Goswami, in a previous interview, that in the Bhagavad Gita, I for some reason got tongue-tied on that, Krishna says to Arjuna, "All these things are in me, but I am not in them." That's a little different than the Western tradition. What does he mean by that?
It is a very, 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 very good question. I don't usually get this kind of question. So, but let's engage with it. It's wonderful wisdom. All things are in me, but I am not in them. This idea that consciousness is the ground of being is very important to recognize. But that gives us also the point that everything is conscious. And then we notice, we look at a stone and we say, well, but the stone obviously does not seem to have the same kind of awareness that a living object has. Even an amoeba, you know, it is alive. And mm-hmm. So it is different than a stone. So what is lacking? And then Krishna's words start making sense. All things are in me. So the object, like a stone, they are certainly within consciousness. Nothing is outside consciousness. So that part is very clear. But I am not in them. So what it means then is that I am not in them, meaning I am not manifest in them. I am not manifest in them. Manifestation of consciousness, that subject-object split experience, that can come only, quantum physics is making it very clear, only if the object has the capacity of precipitating a quantum measurement. An observation or an experience is the result of a quantum measurement, which in more translatable terms, in more understandable terms, is those transformation of those possibilities that we talked about in an actual object, in the manifest object. Objects are possibilities for consciousness to choose from. When consciousness chooses, these possibilities become actual events of experience. And that can happen only if the object that is involved in looking has the capacity of observership. And that capacity is that, we were talking about that in the last hour, that irreducible complexity, tangled hierarchy, that wholeness, that has to be there in the makeup of that object. Brain has it, a living cell has it, but a stone does not have it. So therefore, Krishna is saying this extremely wise, considering that the Bhagavad Gita was written thousands of years ago, it is extremely wise for that time. They didn't have the advantage of quantum physics, but still intuitively, the writer of Bhagavad Gita knew what he's talking about. Namely, consciousness is not manifest in much of the world. But, of course, everything of the world is within consciousness. Nothing can be outside consciousness.
Well, right. I mean, the idea that there is some reverence even for the inanimate, a tree or a rock or a fish, for that matter, there's reverence for it because it does have as consciousness, but as far as...
It is within consciousness. It's part of consciousness. We experience them as objects, which ultimately is us. So in that sense, of course, you know, we should be very reverential to our environment. That makes sense. But even within saying that, we can make a differentiation between objects and objects that can be subject, that can also have, that with which consciousness can identify, and therefore consciousness can be manifest. In other words, those objects can become aware of experience. The subject-object split can occur in the vicinity, in the proximity of those objects, like a brain or a living cell. Those objects have the capacity of experiencing the world as separate from itself, whereas a stone does not have that capacity. So that distinction can be made without demeaning the stone, without making the stone less than what it is, namely that it is part of the conscious universe, and therefore it cannot be less than that. But it cannot also be more than what it is. It cannot manifest awareness, and therefore it is not, consciousness already has evolved more than the stone. Even in the consciousness of a living cell is greater because it has the capacity of subject-object experience.
Well, some people often say that the universe is folded up inside each and every one of us, and that probably is true, but only in the sense that it's part of our consciousness, not necessarily that it's part of us.
Right, it's part of our consciousness, only in that sense, yes. This is very important. I'm glad you pointed that out. This is very important, and many people have somewhat, this is a slight misconception compared to the gross misconception that the materialist suffers from. But still, this is a slight misconception. We need to distinguish between living, non-living, conscious, unconscious, and all this.
Yeah. In reading a lot of your writings, you can read a few pages and then you have to sit and meditate for a while. It appears there's an axiom, it seems, that if you are spiritual, that you must worship something or work out salvation in fear and trembling before an all-powerful God with limited patience and various inexplicable jealousies. Perhaps spirituality has been forged from the kilns of mortality for you. What does spirituality look like for you now?
Well, it really looks as mysterious as it looked years ago. Mysterious in the following sense. The thing is that, spirituality is the idea of transformation to me. To be able to live in a holistic way, live with wholeness as much as possible. What do I find that keeps me from spirituality, keeps me from that creative unity with the One? The negative emotions mainly. Sometimes it is just incapacity of movement of meaning, but mostly the incapacity of movement of meaning comes from the negative emotions. Negative emotions such as lack of love, that completeness, boredom. Negative emotions such as mood, that slight uneasiness that comes with it, mood swings. So how to work with them is the big challenge. And how to work with them, I know the theory already. The new science gives us clear indications. Negative emotions can only be balanced with positive emotions, and then if you can balance them, then equanimity of the mind is much easier to achieve. And if we have equanimity of the mind, then mind can be active and agile and looking for the new and be creative. And then mind can be whole, because the creativity comes with a sort of a relaxed attitude of life, which will give rise to occasional insights, occasional trip to the unity consciousness. But more than that, it gives life a purposiveness that makes us always unbored. If that makes any sense.
Well, so yeah.
It's not boring.
Yeah, no, right? No.
And so for me, spirituality means all these things, and So it's mysterious because I don't have, I still, you know, don't have that complete equanimity that gives you unlimited access to the spiritual dimension of the world. So it's mysterious in that sense. It comes and goes, in other words.
Well, they used to say of us as, you know, we became more and more scientific. That is to say, we employed a scientific methodology about everything and less on faith, that we were atheistic. And maybe to a certain extent that could be true, in the sense that, you know, we don't recognize that there's one being that has created everything and then we're just, you know, enjoyment for that being. However, I have found that the more that I learn, the more science that I learn and the more non-science that I learn, I am in awe of the spirituality of it all, not the religiosity of it all.
Yes. And you know, I mean, I laughed when you said this one being of whom we are enjoyment. I have encountered this kind of thinking. But it all comes from thinking of that one being as a human being,
yeah.
The separate being that we experience. We, when we speak like that, it seems that the authors are completely incapable of thinking what unity consciousness is like. Mm. It's anything but the separateness that we feel as a human being, anything but. It's very far from it. It's a non-ordinary state of consciousness in which there is no boundary. And so this question that we are enjoyment of some person, that question cannot arise. There is no enjoyment. Enjoyment, the word enjoyment implies a split, a separateness. I am enjoying something separate from me, like I'm enjoying a play, I'm enjoying a cup of coffee. In that separateness is manifest and is emphasized. But it's not enjoyment in that sense. It's joy. Instead, it's joy itself. It's not enjoyment. If you cut the ment and cut the end, then separateness disappears. It's joy itself. So when we are in that state of unity, then there is only joy. There is no person enjoying the other person. The separateness between God and me has disappeared. And because it has disappeared, there is only wholeness, there is only joy, there is only happiness.
Yeah, and I think I kind of refute the idea that there must be a balance between evil and good, that good cannot exist without evil. I think it's nonsense. I think good can exist all by itself, and we don't need evil at all.
Absolutely, absolutely. Good can exist all by itself, and that is what we call God. Of course, evil has a role to play. I mean, what we call evil, which is really separateness from consciousness, from the whole. Good is what takes us towards the whole, and evil is what separates us. It's the opposite movement. Good and evil are movements. One movement is towards the whole, towards wholeness, and the other movement is taking away from wholeness. So, these tendencies we already know. We have both tendencies. So good and evil exist within us. Because we are still struggling. We are struggling to manifest the good within us. And in that struggle, evolution is important. Now, if you look at evolution, you will find that evolution has epochs. And each of these evolutionary epochs began with a geological catastrophe. This catastrophe can be looked upon as the as evil. Like right now, we are approaching a catastrophe. And the evil in this case, you can call the materialistic belief system that we have imposed in our culture and society, that kind of is evil. You can frame things this way. Not necessary, but you could. And so this way of thinking is not bad per se, if you understand in that the evil is just a stepping stone towards good, eventual good, because this separateness has arisen and is arising and is continuing, but it will reach a certain threshold after which paradigm shift will occur and people will be even more capable of moving towards the good than before. So evil exists only because it gives crisis conditions in which we become motivated to be more creative and then create even more good in the society, and that's how evolution proceeds.
Well, so I certainly hope so.
It's part of that evolutionary movement, because in order to be creative, we need a lot of energy to be generated, to be motivated. And motivation often requires the opposite movement. In most people, they will not be motivated until a crisis has come, right? Motivated towards creativity or spirituality is essential to create a crisis for them.
Well, I don't know if most people would. I think most people spontaneously obey the law and are good and ethical and kind to one another. But there is, you know, a significant portion of our society that, you know, very few things short of incarceration will, you know, change their mind that a life of evil is not a good thing. I hope that society evolves within one lifetime. We don't have to go another lifetime in order to have all those that are perpetrating evil figure out that they've had that experience. Now it's time to have an experience as good. And I would hope that in subsequent incarnations that we don't have to experience evil because we already have. And we're moving forward as a race.
If you are so lucky, but don't forget, these negative emotions do continue to separate us. So long as the our instinctual heritage is not balanced by creation of new positive emotional instincts, we are sort of predisposed to have some of these evil experiences. Until we have created the positive emotion brain circuits in our brain, and therefore are capable of balancing ourselves between good and evil. In other words, I'm defining evil as the tendency to go against the direction of consciousness, against the direction towards the whole, against the direction of creating the archetypes in my life. And they come because of the evolutionary history. We have created this instinctual emotional brain circuit, and when we are taken over by them, God forbid, we cannot easily move out of them. You know, it is easy to talk about that. Well, we have, you know, when I'm feeling good, when I'm talking with you in this exciting hours of communication, it feels that we can be totally good. That when I'm caught in that negative emotion, the actuality is that I cannot get out of it very easily.
Yeah.
Therefore, we have to be also very humble in the presence of evil, knowing that, you know, this feelings of good does not last very long. We all are taken up once in a while by these evil spasms, if you will. And when society as a whole does that, we get the problems. For example, today is global warming and terrorism, and these are signatures of evil in the society itself that is taking us away from evolution of consciousness. But what I was saying is that evolution needs these things, and not in the personal level. In the personal level, I agree with you. Evolution, obviously does not need it. But in the totality, if there is a movement away and creating a lot of crisis conditions, then that, in a sense, motivates a lot more people towards creativity, which is the way to move towards the good, than it would otherwise. And perhaps that is the reason that that evil exists,
Well, yeah, I just hope that the humility you're talking about isn't compulsory, and I hope that once we achieve it, we don't become proud, we're humble. That's kind of what we have to think about is the breakthrough where we perhaps change from materialistic point of view to a more spiritual point of view, or we change from a limited negative state to a state of unlimited possibilities. Was there a moment of breakthrough for you?
Well, yes, that breakthrough came for me in the realization. I was talking to a friend. I was struggling with, this quantum measurement problem, the paradox that how possibility become actual events of consciousness, conscious experience. This was a huge problem for me, because in materialism, we cannot understand it. What can convert possibility into actuality? Because material interactions can convert possibility into other possibilities, never actuality. So, and my worldview at that time was materialistic, so nothing but matter is allowed. Everything is matter. So within that worldview, it's impossible to understand quantum physics. Now, one thing, you know, many quantum physicists are advised, nobody understands quantum physics, so don't bother. But I had already decided that, no, I want to understand it, because otherwise my life is just falling apart. There is so much separateness in my life, I just didn't want to live that way. So I was struggling and struggling. And then one day I was talking to a mystic, and he said a sentence, you know, his sentence was, there is nothing but God. That sentence somehow reverberated in my consciousness and made me realize, the insight came, that consciousness is the ground of all being, and one can do science, a new science, on that basis, instead of the old materialist basis that everything is matter. That was the turning point of my life. Mm. So, indeed, after that, the struggle disappeared. I knew that the world is friendly.
Yeah.
So I was not perturbed by evil or perturbed by negative movements or perturbed by my conditioning anymore, because I knew that overall the movement is positive. And overall that positive movement will manifest in me if I am humble, if I am patient, if I have forbearance. You know, it don't come instantly, but it will come. That faith grew. It is very interesting, you know, the same day that I had that insight, I had the insight at night during a discussion in the evening, the same day I was listening to another mystic, very famous mystic in this case, Jiddu Krishnamurti. I don't know if you have heard about him, but he wrote a lot of books and taught a lot of people, again, in the last century. And I was hearing a lecture. And in that lecture, a heckler, after his lecture, he asked for questions, and the heckler said that you always talk about these things, these states, and you know, this being, and you seem to be completely in that being, but it never comes to us. And Krishnamurti said, with such serenity, it must come. So, you know, that became my faith, that yes, it must come, and it does come every now and then. So I think that if we are patient in our spiritual search, it will come.
Yes, I do too. I think that it comes to everyone who puts themselves in the proper receiving mode. We're going to take a quick 2.5 minute break. We're just running just a little bit long. Don't forget the phone lines are open. We'll enter our last hour with Dr. Amit Goswami. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this. I dreamed I saw the night soon.